Blog Talk Radio.
I don't know what you heard about me. But a bitch can't get a dollar out of me. No Cadillac, no birds you can't see. Then I'm a motherfucking B.I.M.P. I don't know what you heard about me. But a bitch can't get a dollar out of me. No Cadillac, no birds you can't see. Then I'm a motherfucking B.I.M.P.
Now shawty, she in the club, she dancing for dollars. She got a thing for that Gucci, that Fendi, that Prada. That BCBG, Burberry, Dolce and Cabana. She feed them fools fantasies, they pay her cause they want her. I spit a little G, man, and my gang got her. An hour later, had her ass up in the Ramada. Them trick niggas in the ear saying they think about her. I got the bitch by the bar trying to get a drink about her. She like my style, she like my smile, she like the way I talk. She from the country, then she like me cause I'm from New York. I ain't that nigga trying to holler cause I want some head. I'm that nigga trying to holler cause I want some bread. I could care less how she perform when she in the bed. Bitch at that track, catch a date and come and pay the kid. Look baby, this is simple, you can't see. You fucking with me, you fucking with a P.I.M.P.
I don't know what you heard about me.
Woo.
But a bitch can't get a dollar out of me. No Cadillac, no birds you can't see. Then I'm a motherfucking P.I.M.P. I don't know what you heard about me. But a bitch can't get a dollar out of me. No Cadillac, no birds you can't see. Then I'm a motherfucking B.I.M.P.
A pimp is happy when his whores giggle. He knows they are still asleep. All whores have one thing in common, just like the chumps humping for the white boss. It thrills them when the pimps makes mistakes. They watch and wait for his downfall. A pimp is the loneliest bastard on earth. He's got to know his whores. He can't let them know him. He's got to be God all the way. Pimp, the story of my life. Iceberg Slim. Read by Carrie Height. Forward. Dawn was breaking as the big hog scooted through the streets. My five whores were chattering like drunk magpies. I smelled the stink that only a street whore has after a long, busy night. The inside of my nose was raw. It happens when you're a pig for snorting cocaine. My nose was on fire, and the stink of those whores and the gangster they were smoking seemed like invisible knives scraping to the root of my brain. I was in an evil, dangerous mood, despite that pile of scratch crammed into the glove compartment. God damn it, has one of you bitches shit on herself or something? I bellowed as I flipped the long window toward me. For a long moment, there was silence. Then Rachel, my bottom whore, cracked in a pleasing ass-kissing voice. Daddy, baby, that ain't no shit you smell. We've been turning all night and ain't no bathrooms in those Trix's cars we've been flipping out of. Daddy, we sure been humping for you, and what you smell is our nasty whore asses. I grin widely, inside, of course. The best pimps keep a steel lid on their emotions, and I was one of the iciest. The whores went into fits and giggles at Rachel's shaky witticism. A pimp is happy when his whores giggle. He knows they are still asleep. I coasted the hog into the curb outside the hotel where Kim, my newest, prettiest girl, was cribbing. Jesus! I would be glad to drop the last whore off so I can get to my own hotel to nurse my nose with cocaine and be alone. Any good pimp is his own best company. His inner life is so rich with cunning and scheming to outthink his whores.
You need to get it, he don't wanna love you the right way, he ain't gonna. It ain't where he's at, it's where he wanna be.
Broadcasting live from NYC. What's good, people? It's your man, S-Dot. It is our duty, it is our responsibility as not just people of color, but as citizens of humanity The objective is to inspire proactive people to productive activities. What's good, people? It's your man, S. Dot. My commitment, first and foremost, is to the restoration and rebuilding of the black family. Black on black love. What's good, people? It's your man, S. Dot. This is why it's important that we've got to get out of the window and start looking in the mirror. Black love is not a passive response. It is a declaration of warfare against those who desire to control and manipulate black men and black women and deprive them over their stewardship over the black family. What's good, people? It's your man, S. Dot. I remind you that this show is for constructive purposes only.
S. Dot has a get-it-done mindset when it comes to achieving. Sharing breakthrough strategies and overcoming solutions for everyday people, he is a communicator of change. S. Dot's most impressive credential is that he keeps it 100 and doesn't water down the whole truth and nothing but the truth. It is this refreshing forthrightness that enables him to speak with a right now relevance to people from many walks of life. His can't stop, don't stop, won't stop attitude is infectious to those who have experienced this inspiring author, motivational speaker, and empowerment coach that is committed to helping those most in need succeed in love and life.
What's good, people? It's your man, S. Dot, back for another exciting episode of the Black Love Experience. And on tonight's show, I have my special host with me, Brother Elias. Brother Elias, are you with me?
Yes, sir, I am.
Right. So on tonight's show, which is entitled Pimpology Decoded, we're going to be talking specifically about the spirit of pimpology. So I want to ask you a question. Do you suffer from silly bitch syndrome? Has your whole self-esteem resulted in you getting played time and time again? Are you tired of the whole leash trying to arrest your personal growth and development, telling you shit like, you can't turn a hoe into a housewife? Well, on this episode, myself and Brother Elias, we're going to be debuting a new series entitled Exposing the Game on the Black Love Experience to teach you how to stop being a victim for lames. Tonight, we're going to share some of our lived and learned commentary and experiences, and more specifically on the audiobook version of the infamous street classic Pimp Pimp by Iceberg Slim. And as many of you know, this provocative, captivated narrative has been one of the most influential tales shaping the lives of the hip-hop generation. We're going to invite you to hear a bit of Pimp for yourself tonight. We thank each and every one of you who have clicked by tonight. And we want to begin, first and foremost, with a warning that this show features explicit game and is not for those who are easily offended by real talk for real people about real life doing real things. So with that being said, if you may have clicked by accident onto this show, and if real language, if abrupt language, if authenticity offends you, we strongly encourage you to click your ass away immediately. That's right. Click your ass away immediately. If you're listening on the archive, we thank each and every one of you who are listening on the archive. We remind you to send us an email at thesdotfiles@gmail.com. Once again, the email is thesdotfiles@gmail.com. Brother Elias, what's going on with you, bro?
Oh, nothing much, brother. I'm just so grateful that and honored that you allowed me to be on this show. This is like a very provocative, very thought-inspiring show, and I'm just happy to join you.
Absolutely, absolutely. So this show has been inspired in response to a number of women who have reached out to me, who sent me inbox messages on Facebook. Once again, if you want to Facebook me, it's / the S dot files. That's THESDOTFILES. And a number of women have been messaging me in the last few weeks, specifically about the spirit of pimpology, which seems to consume a lot of our black males today. And as many of you know, for a number of years, I function in what I would best describe as roosterism. Meaning, as a rooster, I try to peck every hen in the barn. And in my season of roosterism, I consider myself a player, but I came to realize that I was actually only playing myself. And as a result of this, it was a long process for me to detoxify myself from that belief system, because I grew up around a lot of individuals who considered themselves pimps, players, and so forth. And as a result of that, it took me a number of years to recognize that I was really dysfunctional. And a part of my dysfunction began very early in life. I grew up around a lot of individuals who classified themselves as pimps and players. Very early in life, I was introduced to the doctrine of the individual we're going to talk about tonight, Iceberg Slim. So that was very pivotal in shaping my perspective on how I viewed women for a number of years of my life. And it cost me a lot of really significant, great relationships, because I was unable to see the true value of a woman, because I thought from the perspective of a quote-unquote pimp and a player. So for a lot of brothers out there who may be in that pimp season of their life, who may be coming to realize that they want something more than that, this show, I hope, can be a resource, can be a tool to point them in a different direction so that they can make some changes in their life. For those of you who want to call in, the call-in number is area code 347-308-8527. Once again, the call-in number is area code 347-308-8527. So, Brother Elias, what's going on with you, bro?
Yes, sir. I'm just enjoying and honoring. But this subject is very important to me because my personal life was just a little different. My mother, she was a evangelist. Therefore, that allowed around scenarios, you know, pertaining to pimps and suits and what we consider a bad and negative behavior. You know, and also after we left New York, we moved to Los Angeles, you know, Compton, Watts, Long Beach, and what have you. So I do have a very extensive personal experience, you know, in that type of environment. And I saw the results because even my older sister, she used to
We're getting a bit of feedback. I don't know if the brother has dropped out or not. Actually, I see that he's dropped off of the line. So what we're going to do is I want to share with you some actual words from Iceberg Slim, who wrote the book Pimp, which set many of our black male youth on the road to desiring to be a so-called pimp or player. And this is from his album, Reflections. This is a cut entitled Broadway Sam. We'll be back in a minute.
Broadway Sam, the Big Mac Man. You ought to know the name. I almost cried the day he died. It was a dirty shame. He liked to play on old Broadway. That's how he got his name. He lived off the hicks from out in the sticks. He was a master of the long shoe game. He was always pressed, nothing but the best. Vines and kicks he had, a $30 lid, and gloves of kid. Man, his threads were bad. White on whites and black skin tights, and a belt of pure crocodile. When he stepped out, all the hoes would shout. But Sam, why, he just smiled. He was riding high. His limit was the sky. He had all kinds of dough. But he became a junkie, a low-down flunky, when he pulled a dope fiend hoe. Her name was Mabel, and she was able to turn eight kinds of tricks. You'd flip your lid over that kid if you were a hick from the sticks. She was the best in the East and the West once a long time ago. But an armful of junk will take all the spunk out of the very best hoe. She said, "Hey, baby, I don't mean maybe. Give this stuff a try." So he blew his fame. He lost the game. He went and got himself high. He was king of them all till he took that fall, till he made that fatal slip. He thought he was boss when he shot that horse. He thought he was being hip. 2 months it took till he got hooked on the pleasure of the kings. When he got caught with his money lost, he had to hock his things. He pawned his clothes, he lost his home. He really did come down. The king of them all had started his fall. The king had lost his crown. His clothes were tattered, but that didn't matter. Not to Sam, at least. As long as Mabel, his hoe, was able to satisfy his beast. When she went to jail, Sam had no bail to cut old Mabel loose. It was there and then, the moment when Sam just cooked his goose. Without his hoe to bring him dough, Sam started to get sick. He got so sick, he went down on a mick. Big Sam had turned the trick. Yes, Broadway Sam, the Big Mac Man, had really fallen down. He was Sam the Fag, in or out of drag, the funkiest junkie in town. They found him dead, dog shit under his head, on an alley floor. Poor Faggot Sam, that once was a man, had his asshole tore. Just what went down in that part of town on that terrible night, no one knows. But some suppose that he just lost a fight. But I don't buy that. I know where it's at. He died of an overdose. And every night, when the moon is bright, you can see his ghost on old Broadway, where he used to play. He moans his way around, looking for Mabel. That hoe, that was Abel. The bitch that brought him down. Yes, I knew him. And the broad that slew him. He played the game. And he searched for fame. But a faggot, he died in shame.
Got buzz? Advertise your brand and spread your message on the S.Dot File social media network, where real people connect and reflect on love and life every day. To find out more, email the Dot Team at the S.Dot Files@gmail.com.
What's good, people? It's your man, S.Dot, back for the Black Love Experience. And tonight we're talking about Pimpology Decoded. Do you suffer from silly bitch syndrome? Has your whole self-esteem resulted in you getting played time and time again? Are you tired of the whole leash trying to arrest your personal growth and development, telling you shit like, you can't turn a hoe into a housewife? Well, on this episode, S.Dot Brother Elias, we're going to be debuting a new series entitled Exposing the Game on the Black Love Experience to teach you how to stop being a victim for lames.
Yes, sir. I do apologize for what happened. I actually came outside because my reception is real bad in the home. But, yes, I'm back. Sorry about that.
It's all good, brother. It's all good. Call in my business code 347-308-8527. Once again, the call-in number is area code 347-308-8527. And tonight we're going to be examining the work of Robert Lee Maupin, commonly known to most folks as Robert Beck or Iceberg Slim. And he had a 24-year reign as a pimp. He stopped pimping in 1960 after a long prison stint. And as a result of that prison stint, he decided that he was going to share his narrative with the world under the pen name Iceberg Slim. And he retired from the game in 1969. His autobiographical novel, Pimp, The Story of My Life, was published by Holloway House, and a number of books since then. Of those books, you have books like Death Wish, The Naked Soul of Iceberg Slim, Long White Corn, Karn, Trick Baby, All Right, Airtight Willie and Me, Dome Fox, and of course Pimp, as well as a number of other works by Iceberg Slim. And tonight we want to specifically focus on the narrative that he put forth in the book by the name of Pimp. We played the first cut of the book Pimp, and we're going to play a bit more of the book Pimp. And I want to invite each and every one of you to join into the conversation. Once again, the call-in number is area code 347-308-8527. We're going to be playing some excerpts from the book Pimp. And I want to know, what is your feedback? What are your questions about what we called the spirit of pimpology, which seems to be very prevalent today in the minds of many of our young black males, as well as many of our young black females. So we're going to be playing some excerpts of the book Pimp by Iceberg Slim. It's your man, S.Dot. We'll be back in a minute.
As Kim got out, I said, "Good night, baby. Today is Saturday, so I want everybody in the street at noon instead of 7 tonight." I said noon, not 5 minutes after or 2 minutes after, but at 12 noon sharp, I want you down. Got it, baby? She didn't answer, but she did a strange thing. She walked into the street around the hog to the window on my side. She stood looking at me for a long moment, her beautiful face tense in the dim dawn. Then in her crisp New England accent, she said, "Are you coming back to my pad this morning? You haven't spent a night with me in a month, so come back, okay?" A good pimp doesn't get paid for screwing. He gets his payoff for always having the right thing to say to a whore right on lightning tap. I knew my four whores were flapping their ears to get my reaction to this beautiful bitch. A pimp with an overly fine bitch in his stable has to keep his game tight. Whores constantly probe for weakness in a pimp. I fitted a scary mask on my face and said in a low, deadly voice, "Bitch, are you insane? No bitch in this family calls any shots or muscles me to do anything. Now take your stinking yellow ass upstairs to a bath and some shut-eye, and get in the street at noon like I told you." The bitch just stood there, her eyes slitted in anger. I could sense she was game to play the string out right there in the street before my horse. If I had been 10 years dumber, I would have leaned out of that hog and broken her jaw and put my foot in her ass, but the joint was too fresh in my mind. I knew the bitch was trying to booby-trap me when she spat out her invitation. "Come on, kick my ass. What the hell do I need with a man I only see when he comes to get his money? I am sick of it all. I don't dig stables and never will. I know I'm the new bitch who has to prove herself. Well, goddammit, I am sick of this shit. I'm cutting out." She stopped for air and lit a cigarette. I was going to blast her ass off when she finished, so I just sat there staring at her. Then she went on. "I have turned more tricks in the 3 months I have been with you than in the whole 2 years with Paul. My pussy stays sore and swollen. Do I get my ass kicked before I split? If so, kick it now because I'm going back to Providence on the next thing smoking." She was young, fast, with trick appeal galore. She was a pimp's dream and she knew it. She had tested me with her beef, and now she was lying back for a sucker response. I disappointed her with my cold overlay. I could see her wilt as I said in an icy voice, "Listen, square-ass bitch. I have never had a whore I couldn't do without. I celebrate, bitch, when a whore leaves me. It gives some worthy bitch a chance to take her place and be a star. You scurvy bitch. If I shit in your face, you gotta love it and open your mouth wide." The rollers cruised by in a squad car, so I flashed a sucker smile on my face and cooled it until they passed. Kim was rooted there, wincing under the blizzard. I went on ruthlessly. "Bitch, you are nothing but a funky zero. Before me, you had one chilly chump with no rep. Nobody except his mother ever heard of the bastard. Yes, bitch, I'll be back this morning to put your phony ass on the train." I rocketed away from the curb. In the rearview mirror, I saw Kim walking slowly into the hotel, her shoulders slumped. In the hog, until I dropped the last whore off, you could have heard a mosquito crapping on the moon. I had tested out for them. Solid ice. I went back for Kim. She was packed and silent. On the way to the station, I rifled the pages in that pimp's book in my head for an angle to hold her without kissing her ass. I couldn't find a line in it for an out like that. As it turned out, the bitch was testing and bluffing right down the line. We had pulled into the station parking lot when the bitch fell to pieces. Her eyes were misty when she yelped, "Daddy, are you really going to let me split? Daddy, I love you." I started the prat action to cinch her when I said, "Bitch, I don't want a whore with rabbit in her. I want a bitch who wants me for life. You have got to go after that bullshit earlier this morning. You are not that bitch." That prat butchered her, and she collapsed into my lap crying and begging to stay. I had a theory about splitting whores. I think they seldom split without a bankroll. So I cracked on her. Give me that scratch you held out, and maybe I'll give you another chance. Sure enough, she reached into her bosom and drew out close to 5 bills and handed it to me. No pimp with a brain in his head cuts loose a young, beautiful whore with lots of mileage left in her. I let her come back. When at long last I was driving toward my hotel, I remember what Baby Jones, the master pimp who turned me out, had said about whores like Kim. Slim, he had said, a pretty nigger bitch and a white whore just alike. They both will get in a stable to wreck it and leave the pimp on his ass with no whore. You gotta make him hump hard and fast to stick him for the long scratch quick. Slim, pimping ain't no game of love, so prat him and keep your swipe out of him. Any sucker who believe a whore loves him shouldn't have fell out of his mammy's ass. My mind went back to Pepper, then back even further, and I remember what he had said about the Georgia. Slim, a pimp is really a whore who has reversed the game on whores. So Slim, be as sweet as the scratch, no sweeter, and always stick a whore for a bundle before you sex her. A whore ain't nothing but a trick to a pimp. Don't let him Georgia you. Always get your money in front, just like a whore. Preface. In this book, I will take you, the reader, with me into the secret inner world of the pimp. I will lay bare my life and thoughts as a pimp. The account of my brutality and cunning as a pimp will fill many of you with revulsion. However, if one intelligent, valuable young man or woman can be saved from the destructive slime, then the displeasure I have given will have been outweighed by that individual's use of his potential in a socially constructive manner. I regret that it is impossible to recount to you all of my experiences as a pimp. Unfortunately, it would require the combined pages of a half dozen books. Perhaps my remorse for my ghastly life will diminish to the degree that within this one book I have been allowed to purge myself. Perhaps one day I can win respect as a constructive human being. Most of all, I wish to become a decent example for my children and for that wonderful woman in the grave, my mother. Chapter 1. Torn from the Nest. Her name was Maud, and she Georgia'd me around 1921. I was only 3 years old. Mama told me about it. And always when she did, her rage and indignation would be as strong and as emotional, perhaps as at the time when she had surprised her panting and moaning at the point of orgasm with my tiny head wedged between her ebony thighs, her massive hands vice-like around my head. Mama worked long hours in a hand laundry, and Maud had been hired as a babysitter at 50 cents a day. Maud was a young widow. Strangely, she had a reputation in Indianapolis, Indiana, as a devout holy roller. I have tried through the years to remember her face, but all I can remember is the funky ritual. I vaguely remember not her words, but her excitement when we were alone. I remember more vividly the moist, odorous darkness and the bristle-like hairs tickling my face, and most vividly, I can remember my panic, when in the wild moment of her climax, she would savagely jerk my head even tighter into the hairy maw. I couldn't get a breath of air until, like a huge black balloon, she would exhale with a whistling whoosh and relax limply, freeing my head. I remember the ache of the strain on my fragile neck muscles, and especially at the root of my tongue. Mama and I had come to Indianapolis from Chicago, where since the time when she was 6 months pregnant, my father had begun to show his true colors as an irresponsible, white spats-wearing bum. Back in that small town in Tennessee, their hometown, he had stalked the beautiful virgin and conned her into marriage. Her parents, with vast relief, gave their blessing and wished them the best in the promised land up north in Chicago. Mama had 10 brothers and sisters. Her marriage meant one less mouth to feed. My father's father was a skilled cook, and he passed his know-how to my father, who shortly after getting to Chicago scored for a chef's job at a huge middle-class hotel. Mama was put on as a waitress. Mama told me that even with both of them working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, they couldn't save a nickel or buy furniture or anything. My idiot father had come to the big city and gone sucker wild. He couldn't stay away from the high yellow whores with their big asses and bitch dog sexual antics. What they didn't con him out of, he lost in the cheat crap joints. At the hotel one night, he vanished from the kitchen. Mama finally found him thrusting mightily into a half-white waitress lying on a sack of potatoes in a storage room, with her legs locked around his back. Mama says she threw everything she could lift at them. They were unemployed when they walked away from the shambles. My father tearfully vowed to straighten himself out and be a man, but he didn't have the will, the strength to resist the cheap thrills of the city. After my birth, he got worse, and had the stupid gall to suggest to Mama that I be put on a Catholic church doorstep. Mama naturally refused, so he hurled me against the wall in disgust. I survived it, and he left us, his white spats flashing, and his derby hat at a rakish angle. It was the beginning of a bitter winter. Mama packed pressing irons and waving combs into a small bag and wrapped me warmly in blankets, and set out into the bleak, friendless city to ring doorbells, the bag in one arm, and I in the other. Her pitch was something like this. "Madam, I can make your hair curly and beautiful. Please give me a chance. For 50 cents, that's all, I will make your hair shine like new money." At this point in the pitch, Mama told me she would slip the blanket aside to bare my wee big-eyed face. The sight of me in her arm on a sub-zero day was like a charm. She managed to make a living for us. That spring, with new friends of Mama's, we left Chicago for Indianapolis. We stayed there until 1924, when a fire gutted the hand laundry where Mama worked. There were no jobs in Indianapolis for Mama, and for 6 months, we barely made it on the meager savings. We were penniless and with hardly any food when a tall black angel visiting relatives in Indianapolis came into our lives. He fell instantly in love with my lissom, beautiful mother. His name was Henry Upshaw, and I guess I fell as hard for him as he fell for Mama. He took us back to Rockford, Illinois with him, where he owned a cleaning and pressing shop, the only Negro business in downtown Rockford. In those tough Depression times, a Negro in his position was the envy of most Negro men. Henry was religious, ambitious, good, and kind. I often wonder what would have happened to my life if I have not been torn from him. He treated Mama like she was a princess. Anything she wanted, he got for her. She was a fashion plate, all right. Every Sunday when we all three went to church in the gleaming black Dodge, we were an outstanding sight as we walked down the aisle in our fresh, neat clothing. Only the few Negro lawyers and physicians lived as well, looked as well. Mama was president of several civic clubs. For the first time, we were living the good life. Mama had a dream. She told it to Henry. Like the genie of the lamp, he made it a reality. It was a 4-stall opulent beauty shop. Its chrome gleamed in the black gold motif. It was located in the heart of the Negro business section, and it flourished from the moment its doors opened. Her clientele was for the most part whores, pimps, and hustlers from the sprawling red light district in Rockford. They were the only ones who always had the money to spend on their appearance. The first time I saw Steve, he was sitting getting his nails manicured in the shop. Mama was smiling into his handsome olive-tinted face as she buffed his nails. I didn't know when I first saw him that he was the pinstripe snake who would poison the core of our lives. I certainly had no inkling that last day at the shop, as live billows of steam hissed from the old pressing machine each time Henry slammed its lid down on a garment. Jesus! It was hot in that little shop. But I loved every minute of it. It was school vacation time for me, and every summer I worked in the shop all day, every day, helping my stepfather. That day, as I saw my reflection on the banker's expensive black shoes, I was perhaps the happiest black boy in Rockford. As I applied the sole dressing, I hummed my favorite tune, Springtime in the Rockies. The banker stepped down from the shine stand, stood for a moment as I flicked lint from his soft, rich suit. Then, with a warm smile, he pressed an extravagant 50-cent piece into my hand and stepped out into the broiling street. Now I whistled my favorite tune. Shines were only a dime. What a tip. I didn't know at the time that the banker would never press another coin into my hand, that for the next 35 years this last day would be remembered vividly as the final day of real happiness for me. I would press $5 bills into the palms of shine boys. My shoes would be handmade, would cost three times as much as the banker's shoes, but my shoes, though perfectly fitted, would be worn in tension and fear. There was really nothing out of the ordinary that day, nothing during that day that I had heard or saw that prepared me for the swift, confusing events that over the weekend would slam my life away from all that was good to all that was bad. Now looking back, remembering that last day in the shop as clearly as if it were yesterday, my stepfather, Henry, was unusually quiet. My young mind couldn't grasp his worry, his heartbreak. Even I, a 10-year-old, however, knew that this huge, ugly black man who had rescued Mom and me from actual starvation back in Indianapolis loved us with all of his great sensitive heart. I loved Henry with all my heart. He was the only father I had ever really known. He could have saved himself an early death from a broken heart if instead of falling so madly in love with Mama, he had run as fast as he could away from her. For him, she was brown-skinned murder in a size 12 dress. That night at 8 o'clock, Dad and I flicked the shop's lights out, as always at closing. In an emotion-muffled voice, he spoke my name. Bobby? I turned toward him and looked up into his face, tense and strained in the pale light from the street lamp. I was confused and shaken when he put his massive hands on my shoulders and drew me to him very lightly, just holding me in this strange, desperate way. My head was pressed against his belt buckle. I could barely hear his low, rapid flow of pitiful words. He said, Bobby, you know I love you and your mama, don't you? His stomach muscles were cording, jerking against my cheek. I knew he was going to burst into tears. I said as I squeezed my arms around his waist, yes, Daddy. We love you too, Daddy. We always will, Daddy. He was trembling as he said, you and your mama would never leave me. You know, Bobby, I ain't got nobody in the world but you two. I just couldn't go on if you left me alone. I clung tightly to him and said, don't worry, Daddy. We'll never leave you. I promise. Honest, Daddy. What a sight we must have been. The 6'6" black giant and the frail little boy holding on to each other for dear life, crying there in the darkness. I tell you, when we finally made it to the big black Dodge and we were riding home, my thoughts were turning madly. Yes, poor Henry's fears had foundation. Mama had never loved my stepfather. This kind, wonderful man had only been a tool of convenience. She had fallen in love with a snake, all right. His plan was to cop Mama and make it to the Windy. The dirty bastard knew I would be excess baggage, but the way Mama was gulping his con, He figured he could get rid of me later. Only after I had become a pimp years later would I know Steve's complete plot and how stupid he really was. Here this fool had a smart square broad with a progressive square John husband infatuated with him. Her business was getting better all the time. Her sucker husband was blindly in love, and the money from his business was wide open to her. If Steve had been clever, he could have stayed right there on top of things and bled a big bankroll from the business in a couple of years. Then he could have pulled Mama out of there, and with a big bankroll, he could have done anything with her, even turned her out. I tell you, she was that hot for him. She had to be insane over the asshole to walk away from all that potential with only $2,500 in cash. Steve blew it in a Georgia skin game within a week after we got to Chicago. I have wished to Christ in four penitentiaries that the lunatic lovers had left me in Rockford with Henry when they split. One scene in my life I can never forget, and that was that morning when Mama had finished packing our clothes and Henry lost his inner fight for his pride and dignity. He fell down on his knees and bawled like a scalded child, pleading with Mama not to leave him, begging her to stay. He had welded his arms around her legs, his voice hoarse in anguish, as he whimpered his love for us. His agonized eyes walled up at her as he wailed, "Please don't leave me. You are sure to kill me if you do. I ain't done nothing. If I have, forgive me." I will never forget her face, as cold as an executioner's, which she was, as she kicked and struggled loose from him. Then, with an awful grin on her face, she lied and said, "Henry, honey, I just want to get away for a while. Darling, we'll be back." In his state, she was lucky he hadn't killed her and me and buried us in the backyard. As the cab drove us away to the secret rendezvous with Steve sitting in his old Model T, I looked back at Henry on the porch, his chest heaving as tears rolled down his tortured face. There were too many wheels within wheels, too much hurt for me to cry. After a blank time and distance, we got to Chicago. Steve had vanished, and Mama was telling me in a drab hotel room that my real father was coming over to see us, and to remember that Steve was her cousin. Steve was stupid, all right, but cunning, if you can get what I mean. Mama, at Steve's instruction, weeks before, had gotten in contact with my father through a hustler brother of Mama's in Chicago. When my father came through the hotel door, reeking of cologne and dressed to kill, all I could think was what Mama had told me about that morning when this tall, brown-skinned joker had tossed me against the wall. He took a long look at me. It was like looking in a mirror. His deep down guilt cream puffed him, and he grabbed me and squeezed me to him. I was stiff and tense in the stranger's arms, but I had looked in the mirror too when he came in, so I strung my arms limply around his neck. When he hugged Mama, her face turned toward me, and stony like back there with Henry. My father strutted about the hotel room boasting of his personal chef's job for Big Bill Thompson, the mayor of Chicago. He told Mama and me, "I'm a changed man now. I have saved my money, and now I really have something to offer my wife and son. Won't you come back to me and try again? I am older now, and I bitterly regret my mistakes of the past." Like a black widow spider spinning a web around her prey, Mama put up enough resistance to make him pitch himself into a sweat, then agreed to go back to him. My father's house was crammed with expensive furniture and art pieces. He had thousands of dollars invested in rich clothing and linens. After a week, my hustler uncle brought Steve to visit us and to case the layout. My father bought the cousin angle and broke out his best cigars and cognac for the thieves. It was another week before they took him off. Remember, at the time I had no idea as to what really was going to happen. For many tortured years, she would suffer her guilt. She had made that terrible decision on that long ago weekend, I know my lousy old man deserved what happened to his goods. I know Mama got her revenge, and it was sweet, I am sure. But it was bitter for a kid like me to know that Mama was part of it. Perhaps if Mama had kept that burglary cross a secret from me, in some tiny way, I might have been stronger to fight off that pimping disease. I don't know. But somehow, after that cross, Mama just didn't seem like the same honest, sweet Mama that I had prayed in church with back in Rockford. I went to her grave the other day, and I told her for the 100th time since her death, Mama, it wasn't really your fault. You were a dumb country girl. You didn't understand. I was your first and only child. You couldn't have known how important Henry was to me. I choked up, stopped talking to her beneath the silent sod, and thought about Henry lying rotten, forgotten in his grave. Then through my tight throat I said to Mama, to you, he was ugly. But Mama, I swear to heaven, he was so beautiful to me. I loved him, Mama. I needed him. I wish you could have seen beyond his ugly black face and loved him a little and stayed with him. Mama, we could have been happy. Our lives would have been different. But I don't blame you. Mama, I love you. I paused, looking up at the sky. Hoped she was up there and could hear me. And then I went on. I just wish you were alive now. You would be so proud of me. I am not a lawyer, as you always wanted me to be. But Mama, you have two beautiful grandchildren, and another on the way, and a fine daughter-in-law who looks a lot like you when you were young. The grave next to her had visitors, and an old man with a bright-eyed girl about 10. I stopped my bragging until the pair walked away, and then I said, Mama, I haven't shot any H in 10 years. I haven't had a hole in 5 years. I have squared up. I work every day. How about it, Mama? Iceberg Slim, a square. You wouldn't believe it, Mama. I wear $50 suits right off the rack, and my car is 10 years old. You gotta believe it now, Mama. Goodbye, Mama. See you Christmas. And remember, I'll always love you. When I walked away from my grave, I thought, I don't know. Maybe that prison head shrinker was right when he told me I had become a pimp because of my unconscious hatred for my mother. I know one damn thing. I can't help crying at her grave almost as if I was crying because I did so much to put her there. Maybe the hidden hate that I can't feel wants me to laugh that she's down there in the earth. Maybe my crying is really laughing. About 90 days after Steve smashed my kitten, Mama cast off her spell, and one gray April dawn, while Steve lay in a drunken open-mouth stupor, Mama and I packed what we could carry and moved into a hotel room. It was complete with hot plate and down-the-hall toilet. Steve had stomped on 3.5 years of our lives. I would soon be 14. On August 4th, my birthday, our old friend Steve, with diabolical timing, made that event unforgettable. Since that chilly dawn in April, he had searched the slum streets for his escaped dupes, thirsty for revenge. I waited eagerly in the hotel room for Mama, who had promised to bake a cake in her white woman's kitchen. She said she would be home early at 6 o'clock to celebrate my birthday. Well, she came home all right on the 7th of August. From a hospital, with her broken jaw wired and her body covered with bruises. Steve had stalked her and attacked her with his fists and feet and then escaped through the grimy catacombs of the ghetto. All that night and the next day, I crouched in the dark shadows beneath his stairwell, gripping a gleaming ice pick. He never came back. He had moved. 20 years later, while idly looking from the window of a plush hotel suite, I would see something familiar in the white-haired, stooped figure of a garbage collector on the street 3 stories down. I blacked out. When reason returned, I was down there on the street in the bright morning sunlight clutching a pistol, wearing only a pair of red silk pajamas. As the garbage truck turned the corner a block away out of range, a small crowd of passerby stood, bug-eyed watching the strange scene as Rachel, my main whore, tugged at my arm, pleaded with me to get off the street. That was the last time I saw Steve, but I just don't know, even now, what I would do if our paths crossed. Perhaps that beating Mama took was good, as painful as it was. I remember how it worried me in that cruddy hotel room when the hotel's neon sign outside our window would flash on her face. Her eyes would be bright, riveted on the ceiling. She would be in a trance, remembering, still hot for him. As worthless as that bastard was otherwise, he sure must have been a son of a bitch in the bed. After all he had done to us, she still had a terrible itch for the bastard. That beating was good for her. It cured the itch. Mama had learned a bitter lesson the hard way. The country girl had rolled in the hay with a city slicker, and now I saw all of her sorrow and guilt in her eyes. We couldn't go back to the peaceful green hills of Rockford. She had destroyed a good man back there, a native son. Henry died a year after we left him. Until the grave claimed her, Henry would rise from his own to haunt her in the lonely gloom. Mama was desperate to save at least fragments of her image, to hold fast to the love and respect I had for her in Rockford. I had seen too much, had suffered too much. The jungle had started to embalm me with bitterness and hardness. I was losing page by page the fine rules of thought and deed that I had learned in church, from Henry, from the Boy Scout troop in Rockford. I was sopping up the poison of the street like a sponge. I had begun to play Steve's favorite game, craps, in the alleys after school. Dangerously, I was frantic to sock it to every young girl weak enough to go for it. I had to run for my life one evening when an enraged father caught me on his back porch, punching animal-like astraddle his daughter's head. I had become impatient with the unusual thickness of her maidenhead. Chapter 2. First Steps into the Jungle. The slide was greased. I was starting my long plunge to the very bottom of the grim pit. I guess my trip downward really was cinched when I met a petty hustler who was very likable, and we became pals. My hustler pal was called Party Time. By the time he was 23, he had done 4 bits in the joint. On each fall, he had been jacked up for either strong-arm robbery or till tapping. He got his moniker hung on him because as soon as he scored for scratch, he would make fast tracks to the nearest underworld bar. When he got inside the door, he would shout, "All right, you poor-ass bastards, it's party time, and Joe Evans is in port, with enough scratch to burn up a wet elephant. All you studs, stop playing stink finger with these long cock whores, and everybody belly up to the log and get twisted on me." His flat African features were pasted to a skull that could have belonged to a caveman. He was short, powerful, and shiny black. He was ugly enough to break daylight with his fist, but for some curious reason, he was irresistible to many of the thrill-seeking white women who sneaked into the black side of town, panting as they chased after that hoary myth. "Nigger men do it so good, it thrills you to your toenails." There was a fast sheet joint with the trick rooms in the rear, right on the alley. I was peeping one night into one through a frayed shade when I saw Party Time for the first time. My eyes were bugging when I saw the tall Viking-type white man, his tiny but voluptuous female white companion, and Party Time taking their clothes off. Finally, they stood there, naked. I could see their lips moving, so I pressed my ear and eyes sidewise against the window that was open a couple of inches at the top to get the sound. The white joker was tenderly hefting Party Time's wet. His horizontal axe cast a cruel shadow across the snowy peaks, rose-tipped. My trouser front His horizontal axe cast a cruel shadow across the snowy peaks, rose-tipped. My trouser front was tinted as I pressed even tighter against the window. I had never seen anything like this back in Rockford. Then, to my amazed ears, the white man said a strange thing as he pulled a chair to the end of the bed and sat on the very edge of it. He was breathing hard when he said, "All right now, boy. Stab it into her. Hurt her. Punish her. Crucify her. Good boy. Good boy." The broad looked so fragile and helpless to my naive eyes that I felt a pang of pity pulse inside me as she moaned and whimpered in painful pleasure beneath the black demon savagely pile-driving between the jerky white legs, jackknifed, imprisoned behind the sweating, hunching black shoulders. Like he was trying to make a home, Party Time was asking in a hoarse voice over and over, "Beautiful bitch, is it good? Beautiful bitch, is it good?" The white man was an odd, funny sight as he raced around the arena like a demented Caesar, cheering on his merciless black gladiator. Finally, when the show was over and they started to dress, I went to the front and sat on a stoop next to the joint. I wanted to get a close-up of the freaks. When they got to the sidewalk in their street clothes, they were disappointingly normal. Just a clean-cut white couple having a parting chat with a grinning black Negro. The mixed-up couple went down the sidewalk away from me. Party Time came toward me. He didn't notice me sitting on the stoop. I was itching with curiosity, so I hit on him when he came abreast. It startled him. His face got stiff. I said, "Hey, Jack, how you doing? That sure is a fine silk girl, huh? You got a square to spare?" He fished a cigarette from his red shirt pocket, handed it to me, and said, "Yeah, kid, she's fine as a Valentine. Two sights I ain't never seen, and that is a pretty bulldog and an ugly white woman." He was spouting cliches, but to a small town boy he came off witty as hell. I was in that brain-picking mood, so I put the snow machine into high gear to hold him. My eyes bucked in mock awe as I lit the square. I said, "Thanks, man, for the square. Christ, that's a sporty vine you got on. I wish I could dress like you. You sure are clean aplenty." He took the bait like a rapist in a nudist colony for the blind. He flopped down on the stoop beside me. He poked his chest out, his eyes flashing like a pinball machine gone haywire as he got ready to open up. He hiked the pants legs of his green check suit to his calves to show his blood-red socks. The huge zircon on his right pinky glittered under the street lamp as he cracked his knuckles and said, "Kid, my name is Party Time, and I am the best flat-footed hustler in town. Money loves me and can't stay away from me. You see that fine silk broad? I got a double saw to lay her. Course, that ain't nothing. It happens all the time. I could be one of the greatest pimps in the country if I was lazy, and I didn't have so much good hustler in me." I sat there listening to his bullshit until 2 a.m. He was likable, and I was hungry for a pal. He was an orphan, and he had just done a 2-year bit straight up, his fourth 2 months before. He had a head full of wild, risky hustles he wanted to try. He needed a partner. He tried all of them on size for me. I got home at 2:20. About 1 minute later, I heard Mama's key in the door. She had served a banquet for her white folks. I just made it into bed with all my clothes on when she came to look in on me. I was snoring like a drunk with a sick sinus when she kissed me goodnight. I lay thinking in the darkness until daybreak, putting myself into and trying to size myself into one of those quick buck schemes that Party had plotted. When the sun came up fat and bright, I knew I would give the Party's version of the Murphy a whirl. I didn't know his version was crude and dangerous, and only a weak imitation of the real Murphy. Years later, I discovered that the Murphy, when played by experts, was a smooth, short con game with a slight risk. In any section where Negro whores operate, white men will flock to trick with them. I met Party several times after school at a pool room. He ran my roll down to me, and the next Friday night we got down with our hustle. Mama was serving a party, so I could stay in the streets until at least 1 a.m. Around 10 that night in an alley in the heart of the Vice section, 7th and Bleet Streets, we unwrapped the package that Party had brought. I rolled up my pants legs beyond my bony knees. I slipped into the 25-cent red cotton dress from the Salvation Army. I put on the frayed red satin high-heeled shoes. I pinned a scraggly piece of hair just inside the front inner band of the faded blue straw bonnet. When I tilted it on my head at a sexy angle, the ringlets of uneven hair hung down over my eyes like bangs. I stood wide-legged, flexed my thigh and hip muscles against the tight red dress, aping the horse stance. Party looked me over head to toe. I was wondering how I came off as a broad. He shook his head, hunched his shoulders, and walked toward the mouth of the alley to catch a sucker. I got the answer when he reached the sidewalk. He twisted his bead toward me and said, "Listen, man, stay out of the light, okay?" Within 5 minutes, he gave me the office that some action was coming down the street. I watched Party giving the pitch to a short, elderly white man. I wonder if I had enough voltage as a broad to come through with my end of the deal. He officed my flash cue an instant before the white man peeked up the alley at me. I jerked my skinny ass in a series of bumps and grinds and hopefully waved him toward me. That skinny black bitch he saw must have lit a fire in him all right. He fumbled his hide from his hip pocket and handed a bill to Party. The chump started up the alley at a hell of a pace for an old bastard. He had paid his money, and he was red hot to take his chance to stick that hot nigger bitch waiting for him in the shadows. He had no chance, but in a way he was lucky. Lucky that his hide had not been fat with greenbacks. If he had been loaded, when I evaporated through the gangway, Party, instead of fading away, would have come into the dark alley behind the sucker and robbed him with brute force. My heart was pounding in excitement as I galloped through the alleys towards our next prearranged duck blind. I took a new station several blocks away. Party time came moments later. Looked up the alley and hooked the tips of his thumb and index fingers into an all is well oh. We beat several other suckers. None had the fare for the strong arm. We worked until 12:30. Then, unlike Cinderella, I stashed my mildewed costume, got my half of the $70 take, and raced home. Mama came in a half hour after I did. As in all other things, there are many Murphys. Real Murphy players use great finesse to separate a mark from its scratch. The most adept of them prefer that a trick hit on them. It puts the Murphy player in a position to force the sucker to qualify himself and to trim the mark not only for all his scratch, but his jewelry as well. When approached and quizzed by a mark as to where a girl can be found, the Murphy man will say, "Look, buddy, I know a fabulous house not more than 2 blocks away. Brother, you ain't never seen more beautiful, freakier broads than are in that house. One of them, the prettiest one, can do more with a swipe than a monkey can do with a banana. She's like a rubber doll. She can take 100 positions." At this point, the sucker is wild to get to this house of pure joy. He entreats the con player to take him there, not just direct him to it. The Murphy player will prat him to enhance his desire. He will say, "Man, don't be offended, But Aunt Kate that runs the house don't have nothing but high-class white men coming to her place. No niggas or poor white trash. You know, doctors, lawyers, big-shot politicians. You look like a clean-cut white man, but you ain't in that league, are you? At this pricking of his ego, the mark is ready for the hook. He will protest his worth as a person and his right to go where any other son of a bitch can go. Hell, for a high-class lay, a double saw wouldn't faze him. Few can resist the charm of exclusivity in its myriad forms. The con player, still hedging, shoring up firmly the convincer, will then say, "Man, I believe you, and everything you say is true as gospel. In fact, I like you, pal, but try to see my side of it. First, to show you I trust you, I'll tell you a secret. I've been working for Aunt Kate's house for many years now as her outside man, you know, making sure only nice dates went up there. Aunt Kate and I got an airtight system. Friend, I know you will help me keep Aunt Kate's rules, so let's go. I am taking you to the thrill of your life." While keeping up an inflaming description of the whores and sexual delights to be found only at Aunt Kate's, the Murphy player had steered the sucker to a pre-chosen, neat, attractive apartment building. In the foyer, in a subtle but compelling manner, the con player nudged the mark into a fast meeting of minds, the question agreed upon. As hot as he was, he couldn't go up before he checked in all valuables. It was Aunt Kate's unshakable rule. Aunt Kate was rock right, never to tempt or trust a whore. Only fools trusted whores, right? The mark wasn't a fool, right? Right. The con player produced a sturdy brown envelope. The sucker counted all the scratch in his pocket into the hand of Aunt Kate's outside business manager. The efficient, affable manager shoved it into the envelope, licked it, sealed it, and stuck it in his pocket for safekeeping from the possible larceny in the hearts of the gorgeous dolls upstairs, third floor, first apartment to the left, number 9 to be specific. The sucker was in a bubbly mood as he took the stairs 3 at a time. He liked that nigga down there who was protecting his money. What had he told him when he gave him the shiny gold-colored metal check? "Harry Powell, this one's on me. Just go up and hand it to Aunt Kate. Everything is going to be all right. If you want, you can buy me a drink when you come down." The two strikes that had whipped across the white man's mental plate and had set him up for the kill. The third strike was first, his desperate need to relieve himself into a black body. The second was his complete inability to conceive that the black boy before him was intelligent enough to fool him, to fashion the Murphy dialogue. Party and his raw-boned lore after 3 weekends of fair success with the Murphy ran head-on into a round brick balloon. It was only 5 feet tall, but it weighed close to 300 pounds. It was a Saturday night around 10. The vice section was overrun with Johns. It seemed that every white man in town was out there, scratching one hand and a rod in the other, ripping and running after the black whores with the wildest, blackest asses. Party and I set up a blind on the fringe of the section because, with all of that mad action in the center, it would be a hectic cat-and-mouse game with the cruising, rousting vice squad. I would have gotten something less than pure kicks to get busted making like a broad. Party hadn't strong-armed since his last bit. The only reason he hadn't was simply that none of the Johns we had fleeced was carrying a wad. We were fishing in a sand pile. All the hungry suckers were swimming in center stream. From my Murphy station in the alley, I watched Party eagerly for the office for action. Around 11:30, I was standing on one leg and then the other like a bored crane with a 25-cent dress on. About 5 minutes later, the office came through. Was it a man? A machine? No. It was a walking, living, round balloon with a fat poke and a flaming itch for black kush. It stood there fascinated by my furious bumps and grinds. I felt prickly feet of excitement stomping along my spine when the balloon took his hide out. Party jerked rigid at the sight of its contents. Even as the balloon bounced toward me, I inched toward my point of evaporation. I knew the strong-arm lust had exploded inside Party, and sure as hell, he was going to come up that alley and smash the air out of the balloon. I quit the scene and poked my head into the alley, farther up. I could hear guttural grunting, the kind of sound a heart case makes when he's riding hard to convince a nympho that he's a raging tiger. It was the balloon that was grunting, and he held Party in a crushing stranglehold. My heartbeat backfired and melted the starch in my props. I collapsed onto a garbage can. The balloon was also a weightlifter. Poor Party was hanging high over the head of the monster and then flung to the alley floor with a shattering whoomp, where he lay like a rag doll. The balloon hollered as he leaped into the air and then fell like a ton of concrete on moaning Party. I was almost puking in pity for Party, but I just couldn't find the strength to get off that garbage can and join the fray. Anyway, it wouldn't have been ladylike. The derrick scooped Party from the alley and flung him across his back. I watched Party's rubber neck bumping against the balloon's rear end as he was carried to the sidewalk. I jetted out of there and went to the roof of my building. I watched for the rollers I was sure were coming to bust me, but they never came. Old Party had had the funky luck to try the strong arm on a professional wrestler called the Blimp. Party went back to the joint for a yard after he got out of City Hospital. One thing about Party, he wasn't copper hatred. He never tipped my name to the heat. When he got older and lost his nerve to hustle, he got a crazy desire to pimp. He wasn't the type, but he kept trying until he ran the gorilla game on a dope dealer's broad and was set up for a hot shot. Party tried his fists and muscle until the pimp game croaked him. The pimp game is like the watchmaker's art. It's tough. Party went through his life struggling to make a watch while wearing boxing gloves. Party's bad break sobered me, and I started hearing what was going on in day classes at school. At 15, amazingly, I graduated from high school with a 98.4 average. There was a sizable alumni of Tuskegee, a Southern Negro college, who insisted upon Mama letting them underwrite all expenses for my education at their alma mater. Mama leaped at the chance. The alumni went into debt and sent me down to their hallowed school with a sparkling wardrobe. They didn't know I had started to rot inside from the street poisoning. It was like the poor chumps had entered a poison horse in the Kentucky Derby and were certain they had a cinch winner. They couldn't know that they had their hearts and blood money on a born loser. A rich bonanza was at stake, the success of my very life itself, the rescue of Mama from her awesome guilt, the trust and confidence of that big-hearted alumni. My mental eyes had been stabbed blind by the street. I was like a freakish joker who had gotten clap in his eyes from a mangy street whore. On campus, I was like a fox in a chicken coop. Within 90 days after I got down there, I had slit the maidenhead on a half dozen curvy co-eds. Somehow, I managed to get through the freshman year, but my notoriety was getting awful. The campus finks were envious, and it was too dangerous to continue to impale co-eds on my stake. In my sophomore year, I started going into the hills near the campus to juke joints. With my slick northern dress and manner, I was Prince Charming in spades to the pungent, hot-ass maidens in the hills. A round-butt, barefoot beauty, 15 years old, fell hard for me. One night, I failed to meet her in our favorite clump of bushes. I had stuck her up to keep a date in another clump of bushes with a bigger, hotter, rounder ass than hers. Through the hill grapevine, she got the wire of my double cross. It was high noon on campus the next day when I saw her. I had just walked out of the cafeteria onto the main drag. The street was lousy with students and teachers. She stood out like a pope in a cat house. Her potato sack dress was grimy and dirty as hell from the long trip from the hills. Her bare feet and legs were rusty and dusty. She saw me. A wild heart beat after I saw her. She battle-cried like an Apache warrior, and before I can get the wax out of my props, she had raced close enough toward me so that I could see the insane fury in her eyes. Beads of sweat clung to the kinky hair in the pit of her arm that was upraised. Gripping like a dagger of a broken Coca-Cola bottle, the jagged edges were glinting in the sun. The screaming teachers and students fled like terrified sheep in the wake of a panther. I don't remember what athlete was reputed to be the fastest human in the world that year, but for those few seconds after I got the wax out of my legs, I was. When I finally looked back through the cloud of dust, I saw the crazy broad as a speck in the distance behind me. Mine had been a carpet offense, and I was on it in the office of the school president. I stood before him, seated behind his gleaming mahogany desk. He cleared his pipes and gave me a look like I had jacked off before the student body. He held his head high, his nose reaching for the ceiling like I was crap on his top lip. In a sneaky southern drawl, he said, "Boy, you are a disgrace to our fine institution. I'm shocked that such has occurred. Your mother has been informed of your bad conduct. Our board is considering your dismissal. In the meantime, keep your nose clean, boy. You are not to leave campus for any reason." I could have saved my worry over dismissal. That alumni had powerful pull, all right. I got a break and got the chance to stay until midterm of the sophomore year, when I went for the okey-doke. I took a bootlegging rap for a pal. "What goes around comes around," old Hustlers had said. Party had taken our beef without spilling. Anything with a buzz in it was in great demand on campus. A pint of rot-gut whiskey brought from $7.50 to $10, depending on supply. My roommate had scratch and a Fagin disposition. He was a Sharpie from a number racket family in New York. We made a deal. He would bankroll our venture if I copped the merchandise and sold it. He got my promise that I would keep his part in it a secret. He was a fox for sure. He gave me the scratch, and I slipped up into the hills to contact a moonshiner who would supply me. Perhaps I don't have to say that I carefully avoided any contact with that broad who pushed me to that track record. I scored for a connection, and the markup on campus was 400%. Everything was beautiful. The merchandise was moving like crazy. I was sure that when I got back home for the summer, I would have enough scratch to turn everybody green with envy. I recruited a co-ed I had laid to distribute for me in her dorm. It was the beginning of the end. There were two Jasper co-eds in her dorm who were fierce rivals for the love of a coffee-colored, curvaceous doll from a country town in Oklahoma. The doll was really dumb. She had no idea of the lesbian kick, so naturally she couldn't know she was a target. Eventually, the crafty of the two Jaspers wore the doll down and turned her out. They had to keep the secret of their romance from the other Jasper because she was so tough and built like a football player. She was doing money favors for the doll, hoping to get into her pants. The doll and her jockey were in cahoots, playing the sucker Jasper hard for the scratch. One night, the doll and her jockey were tied into a pretzel doing the 69 and drunk as hell on my merchandise when their passionate outcries reached the ears of the muscular Jasper. The bloody fight and spicy details were topics for statewide gossip. In the heat of the investigation, my agent fell apart. She put the finger on me, and within a week, I was on the train going back to the streets for good. I didn't turn over on my roommate. I obeyed the code. Mama changed jobs a week after I got back to nurse and cook for a wealthy white recluse. Now I really stuck my nose in the devil's ass. Mama had to stay on the place. I saw her once a week on Sunday when she would come in for a day. That was the only time I stayed at the hotel. I had found a fascinating second home, a gambling joint run by a broken-down ex-pimp and murderer called Diamond Tooth Jimmy. The 2-carat stone wedged between the upper front rotting teeth was the last bulk memento of his infamy as the top ass-kicker of the 1920s. He boasted endlessly that he was the only nigger pimp on earth who had ever pimped in Paris on French girls. I was to discover later, when I would meet and be trained by the master, that Jimmy was a mere buffoon, an amateur not fit to hold the master's coat. After the suckers were trimmed and all the shills had been paid, Jimmy would lock the door and then, like a ritual, light up a thin brown reefer. As he talked, he would pass it to me, cursing me affably for not inhaling deeply and holding the smoke, as he put it, deep in my belly. When dawn broke, he would go out through the joint door home to the 19-year-old Jasper, on whom he lavished furs and jewels. He was a real sucker. I would go to bed in the tiny cubicle in the rear of the joint and dream fantastic dreams. Always beautiful whores would get down on their knees and tearfully beg me to take their money. For several months, I had been screwing the luscious daughter of a popular band leader. She was 15. Her name was June, and she had a wild yen for me. She had a habit of waiting down the street from the gambling joint until Jimmy left, and then she would come up and get on the army cot with me. She would stay until 7 o'clock at night. She knew I had to clean the joint for action around 9. One day, around noon, I asked her, "Do you love me enough to do anything for me?" She said, "Yes." So I said, "Even turn the trick?" She said, "Anything." I put my clothes on and went to the street and saw an old gambler whom I knew was a trick and told him what was upstairs. Sure enough, he gave me a $5 bill, the asking price, and I took him upstairs and let him in on her. She turned him in less than 5 minutes. My 17-year-old brain reeled. This was still the Depression. I could get rich with this girl and drive a big white Packard. My next prospect was all wrong. He was an acquaintance of the band leader, June's father. He went upstairs, saw her, and called the father in Pittsburgh. The father called the local police department, and my pimping career died a warning. When the detective came, I was still out there looking for tricks for the down payment on that big white Packard. Diamond Tooth's bullshit had screwed me for certain. My mother, of course, was shocked. She was sure it was a frame-up. That June, that evil girl, had led her sweet little Bobby astray. At the county jail 2 days before my trial, I left my cell on an attorney consultation pass. A short, gopher-faced Negro sat in the cage at an old oak desk, grinning at me. My blood ran cold. My palms got slippery wet as I took a seat across from him. The gleaming yellow gold teeth filling his mouth had been a flash of doom. Christ, I thought, a deep south nigger lip. Didn't Mama know that most of them turned to jelly when defending a criminal case? The rodent wiped his blue-black brow with a soggy handkerchief and said, "Well, Bobby, it seems that you're in a little trouble, huh? I am Attorney Williams, an old friend of your family. I knew your mother as a girl." My eyes sent special delivery murder across the table to that ugly bastard. I said, "It isn't a little trouble. Under the max, I can get a fin." He fingered his dollar necktie and hoisted his starved shoulders inside the jacket of his cheap vine and said, "Oh, now let's not be fatalistic. You are a first offender, and I am positive it will mitigate the charge." Rest assured, I will press the court for leniency. Now tell me the whole truth about your trouble. Anger, everything drained out of me. I was lost, stricken. The phony would lead me to the slaughter. I knew I was already tried and convicted and sentenced to the joint. The only loose end was for how long. Without hearing it myself, I ran down the details to him and stumbled blindly back to my cell. On my trial day in the courtroom, the shaky bastard was so nervous before the bench when he pleaded me guilty that the same cheap vine that he had worn at our first meeting was soaked by his sweat. He was so shook up by the stern face and voice of the white, hawk-faced judge that he forgot to ask for leniency. That awful fear the white folks put into him down south was still painfully alive in him. He just stood there, paralyzed, waiting for the judge to sentence me. So, I looked up into the frosty blue eyes and said, "Your Honor, I am sorry for what I did. I have never been in trouble before. If Your Honor will just give me a break this time, I swear before the Lord I won't ever come back down here. Please, Your Honor, don't send me to the pen." The frost deepened in his eyes as he looked down at me and intoned, "You are a vicious young man. Your crime against that innocent young girl, against the laws of this state, is inexcusable. The very nature of your crime precludes the possibility of probation. For your own good and for that of societies, I sentence you to the state reformatory to a term for not less than 1 year and for not more than 18 months. I hope it teaches you a lesson." I shrugged off the wet hand of the lip from my shoulder, avoided the tear-reddened eyes of Mama sobbing quietly in the rear of the courtroom, and stuck my hands out to the bailiff for the icy cold handcuffs. June's old man was a big wheel with lots of muscle in the courts. He had gone behind the scenes and pulled strings and put the cinch on the joint for me. My sentence was for carnal knowledge and abuse, reduced from pandering, because you can't pander for anything except a whore, and June's old man wasn't about to go for that. Yes, I was sure working at that first patch of gray in my mother's hair. Steve would have been proud of me, don't you think? My sentence to the Wisconsin Green Bay Reformatory almost cracked Mama up. There were several repeaters from the reformatory on my tier at county jail who tried to bug the first offenders with terrible stories about the hard time up at the reformatory while we were waiting for the van to take us upstate to the reformatory. I was too dumb to feel anything. A fool I was to think the dummy was a fairy tale. This audiobook is continued on Disc 2. Make it hot.
Lame. S-Dot is now coaching on the game. Get the Getting Over It guide, exposing the game. Learn how to stop playing yourself on RTK Communications. Don't hate the player. Learn to peep game. Exposing the game, the first volume of the 7 series Get Your Mind Right, from inspiring author, motivational speaker, and empowerment coach, S-Dot Jones.
What's good, people? It's your man, S-Dot, back with Brother Elias. Tonight's episode is entitled Pimpology Decoded, and we're talking about decoding the spirit of pimpology. Brother Elias, you with us?
Yes, sir. Yes, I'm still here.
So what did you think of the book so far?
The book is correct. I don't know if y'all got an opportunity to hear what I was saying before the phone disconnected, but I do have an extensive history of being around that type of environment as a young child. I grew up around, you know, in Los Angeles, Watts, Compton, and New York, what have you. And my older sister used to hang around and party with Rick James and things of that nature. But one thing that, as a person that's coming of age, one thing that made me a little different from most people is most people, they don't pay attention to their own advice. I remember watching the old pimps in their young days and watching them as elderly men, and they always had wisdom for our young brothers to not really to continue to perpetuate that behavior. But most of us, you know, tend to believe that it will not happen to me. And I just think that is a continuation of our problem. And as you listen to him, you know, since he has children now and what have you. But as you know, I have to use the scriptures as well because a lot of our people are still religious. The scripture says, I will curse the second and third generation. Now, let's separate God from that into that equation. It is known scientifically that the first 5 months of a woman's pregnancy determine the characteristics of a child. Now, most women really do not value themselves because it was a probability that their mother didn't value themselves when they were carrying them, you know, while they were pregnant. So we continue to perpetuate this, you know, this damnable behavior that leaves us in regret. Now, this brother's wisdom on here, yes, I love to listen to his wisdom. Of course, we have not got to the final stages of this book. So he's in the nitty-gritty and the meat part already, initial stage of his life. But I hope the sisters will listen to this message because remember you wanted to empower some women out here. Now, sisters, one thing that you have to understand, this is very important for you. You co-create with creation, or you co-create with God. Now, when you listen to the brother's story, if his mother was responsible for who she truly was, meaning that a woman raising a child, and I guarantee this brother's story is just a normal story like most people who I live with and grew up with. They just decide to accept their environmental circumstances and to perpetuate that damnable behavior. But back to you women, knowing that you have a womb and knowing that you co-create with God, and it is known, especially if you pass 12 years old, that either you can create a Jesus, a person who is righteous, or you can create a Satan or a person who loves to destroy his people because y'all create men and women. So sorry to say, but y'all do have a very serious power here. Now I know the new age people and a new group of people talking about this is the it's been the masculine age, now we need to bring the feminine back on the planet, and I do not agree with that feminine perspective because all human beings have a belly button and all male and females had to come through a womb of a woman. So you guys have the feminine principle, have never left the earth. The earth is called Mother Earth. So again, everything here is still feminine. You can it could not just disappear into the atmosphere into some other energy or some other planet. So again, that just an illusion or an excuse to not accept our full responsibility. Women, yes, I know that y'all hate some of the scriptures because the scriptures seem to be more negative and more painful for you guys. But again, it is proven, and most powerful teachers like the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and even Prophet Muhammad and all these other teachers know that most of their teaching was for women because it is known that if you teach a man, you teach an individual, but if you teach a woman, you teach a nation of people. Now we have science to prove the fact that your womb is so important, and most people know that before you even, you know, conceive the child, you need to get yourself ready. And even myself personally, before my wife, even before we conceived the child, she became vegan. We didn't watch scary movies and anything that has some kind of negative connotation to it. And then my son, he is a beautiful and a well-rounded human being without a shadow of a doubt because we accepted the responsibility of you guys' womb. Now, I know most of us at this point in the game, we have been hurt, by societal circumstances, via our parents or uncle or aunt or what have you, just like this brother was. And, you know, in his book he was saying that, you know, when he was young, a babysitter, what have you, you know, did some things. And we all had experienced that. But again, when you listen to these people, because one of my quotes I always say and is always known, watch those who come before you so you may not fail. Will Smith said something that was very good. He said, he was talking to young people, and it goes for old people as well. He said two things, running and reading. He said the reason why he said running is because eventually you'll hear the little voice that tell you to stop, but if you keep running, you know you can silence that voice. And he said the second thing is reading, because there have been millions and trillions of people already alive who have already experienced what you experienced and wrote the solution. There is nothing that you will do in your life that somebody have not already experienced. And like I said, that goes for us, but just somehow we just continue to refuse the ancient people's advice, even though the ancients taught us that there are two type of people. One person who will listen and follow through instructions, and another person who have to fall in the potholes and keep bumping their head. Excuse me. Now, if you look at our society, it's very apparent that most of us continue to have to bump our heads. You know, but again, that's why patience and environments like this radio is good for us, so we can have a place to, you know, let out this energy and get some of that stuff off our chest, just like this brother did with his amazing book. And I hope that the younger generation and the younger women out here who really please respect those who came before you. You will not recreate the wheel. You will find yourself in a box. You will find individuals in the situations there before you were there. And that's why books and writing exist. Because a human being will leave physically. They will go back into the earth, but their wisdom and their experiences will continue to live. You see, I know they say if you want to hide something from a Negro, you put it in a book. But again, we have technology, and we have individuals like S. Dodd and myself and others who are willing to share this wisdom, who are willing to respect our own personal experiences and respect those who come before us and then pass down this ancient wisdom that is here to heal and help us. So again, I believe that introduction to that brother's book is amazing, Brother S. Dodd, and that's just my little piece right there for now.
One of the things that stands out to me about this particular narrative that I think that a lot of folks overlook is the particular influence of his mother and his relationship with his mother and how that impacted a lot of things that transpired throughout his life. If you look at the narrative itself, he talks about how his mother, very early in life, in his life, he had a father, and his father didn't particularly bond with him and physically assaulted him, and his mother advised him that his father physically assaulted him, and so he had some deep abiding resentment towards his father. And then he got a father figure and a stepfather who his mother wasn't particularly physically attracted to, and his mother manipulated that situation, even though this father figure had gone above and beyond to provide for the mother and himself. And she manipulated that father figure because of her unresolved issues, and she got caught up in a temporary relationship with an individual who classified himself as a pimp. And as a result of that, she actually even went back to his original father and robbed him. And then this individual who was a pimp ended up hurting her, inflicting physical harm on her. So I think about a lot of the young black males that I meet on a day-to-day basis whose mother figures are making a lot of tragic decisions about a lot of the relationships that they involve themselves in. And I think about how that impacts a lot of the relationships that they try to have with a lot of young black females. A lot of young black females are attempting to have relationships with young black males and not recognizing that many of these young black males have motherless wombs. They may have a mother who is physically present in their life, but that mother may have been present in their life and present in their life in a dysfunctional manner. And as a result of this, you have a whole generation of young black males who have grown up with a great deal of animosity towards their mother. Many of them don't even know how to verbalize this animosity that they have towards their mother, particularly because a lot of these mother figures told these young black males that you are the man of the house, placing them in a role prematurely that they're not qualified to occupy. Or a lot of these mothers place these young men in the role emotionally as their partner, almost, so that a lot of these young black males grow up in a role of being competitive against a lot of the romantic interests that their mothers get involved with. So I think that this contributes a great deal to a lot of the conflict that exists with a lot of black males and their maternal mother figures and a lot of black males and their romantic interest in a lot of women today, because a lot of women don't understand that at the root of why a lot of these black men are desiring, or black males are desiring, to be so-called pimps is because they've recognized that their mothers behaved as whores. Well, I think that oftentimes goes overlooked. And, I mean, it's very difficult for a parent to acknowledge that they have behaved as a whore or a pimp to their child. I know that, with my older daughter who's 12 years old, I know I've always been very open and honest with her in letting her know that at an earlier point in my life, one of the reasons why I was unable to have a healthy relationship with her mother is because I still had the residual effects of functioning in the mindset of someone who was influenced by the whole pimp player mentality, and that deeply impacted my relationship with her mother. And a lot of women won't admit to their sons that they are whores or they've been whores, or that their sons came about as a result of them being whores. A lot of women won't say to their men, male children, you're a pull-out baby. And a lot of these young men know it in their spirit that they're a pull-out baby, that, their mother didn't intend to conceive them and their father didn't intend to conceive them. And I think that this is at the root of a lot of the hostility that exists between a lot of our young men and our young women today, because a lot of these men are pull-out babies. So what do you think about that?
Well, what you said was 110%. But what I like to interject is we have to really, really, really get to the point and really get to the key. That part right there, that is true. Most women are not conscious of the unverbal communication. Emotions have a communication as well. And that's why while the woman is pregnant, like I said before, the first 5 months of a woman's pregnancy determine the characteristics of a child. So if her environment is consistently negative, if she looks into the mirror and says, I'm gaining weight, so those thoughts are negative, so what I'm saying is it's a perpetuation of death and destruction. So by the time her son or daughter has passed through the womb, they already affected by what was going on while they were growing in the womb. You see, and then it is known for a fact that your DNA, you know, really does not affect who you are, because back in the 70s and 80s, you know, psychologists says your environment pretty much can predict or control who you really are. But it, we know today that your intentions, your true intentions, and yes, everybody is hurt, you know, because I was the ugly dude. My whole entire life was that ugly dude, even though I'm not an ugly man and I'm not lacking intelligence or what have you. But like I said, I always was a critical listener while my mother and I was on the streets. I have experienced being molested, you know, by my mother and all these things. So that's why when women come at me with all these excuses, if you will, I can just listen and say, yeah, I understand, because I was there. And yes, I'm the only one that's taking care of my mother right now to this day. So my talk is just not talk. I live what I speak. But I know what goes on the inside of me. I just refuse to retaliate on those who have harmed me. And that's the problem with us today, is trying to learn how to release that pain. Because I can guarantee when you listen to people, at the end of the day, just like this brother in his book, he spoke about the harms and terrors of the things that he went through and how he loved that man that was, you know, substantial and helpful and truly loving. And yes, I wish women would really tell the truth about their nature on the inside of them. Women, sisters, mothers, daughters, you guys have a very serious responsibility. As I say before, you are co-creators with God. Either y'all could bring in a Christ or y'all can bring in an Adolf Hitler or what have you. You understand? So when you read the life of Mary Magdalene, she was a very patient woman. She was a very merciful woman. She read the scriptures. And what I mean by scriptures, it can just be self-love. Someone in our generation or the generation after, what have you, going to have to bear the burdens of the former generation. Now, you and I know that former, because I'm a 70s baby, early 70s, late 60s, they dropped the ball. We know that. But again, we are old enough today to say that, look, we see this problem, so we're going to have to bear the burden. There's a verse in the scriptures when they talked about that the children of Israel were supposed to go to this promised land, but there was giants. And they were so afraid to go and conquer these giants. And how a friend and I, we discussed that scenario in the scriptures, as our situation is, our giants is of the sins of our fathers and mothers. A lot of us don't want to conquer their sins. We only perpetuate their sins. And yes, they do have some women that glorify their sons as their husbands. But again, I like to let us know that the ancient religions and the ancient ways of life, you were grown at 12. And where I grew up, I was like, you know, in Watson Compton, I used to try to raise money, you know, because my mother, like I said, we were homeless. So I've done a lot of things at a very young age, caught the Greyhound trail work bus at 5 years old. You know, so I know how it is to be out there with those people and with that type of mentality and trying to survive. You see, but again, we must take that same strength of truth. And yes, we must take the talks and the anger from the younger generation, because we know their results. There is nothing new under the sun. So again, women, you are a very powerful being. You create human life. And you know, and just like his mother, she did not want to believe that he was the actual criminal that they were saying in the courtroom. And most women are the same way. Their sons can be the murderer or what have you, and oh, that's not my baby. But again, they refuse to look at themselves. You do not have to be a prostitute. You do not have to do that. And if you desire to be a prostitute, because that's one thing that I have learned, most of them are highly intelligent. Most of the strippers and most of the porn stars, what have you, are extremely intelligent. And they know that cat and mouse game. But again, we need to get to a point in our lives that we say, look, enough is enough. I know everybody would not do it, but you know what's so funny? While I was growing up, I loved to read people's biographies. And at the end of the day, when that individual had a terminal cancer or a terminal illness and they was on their deathbed, they always gave the same advice to the younger generation. And I just hope that we can get the strength to continue shows like this to let people know to really look in the mirror. Yes, we all have these demons, but listen, women, all the prophets and all the messengers and all the light human beings always had their hand out towards women. You guys are so powerful, and please know y'all's responsibility. We already know the things we've done in the past, but let's stand up to our evils and write this information, write this book, and go teach the younger generation, because it is easy for somebody to go to university and try to teach somebody. But we all know if a person was on crack for 10 or 20 years and got themselves off of crack, they'd be more qualified to teach a person to try to get out of the same scenarios they were in. So, yes, Brother S-Dot, that is a very perfect example that you gave about how we like to perpetuate the sins and the ills. And if you know anything about Iraq and these other countries, the U.S. government know that when they took out their mothers, because most of the Islamic women, the one who oppressed the Islamic women are the ones who lost their mothers while they were children. So most of the leaders in these countries are orphans, and that's why they don't have the love for the women like the former generations. But again, even as soon as y'all find out y'all are pregnant, there are support groups out there. There are individuals. You do have the right to find those who have the same mind as you. We have the internet now. We are a global society, and we do have individuals who are very consistent, like Brother S-Dot and myself, and some other human brothers and sisters out there. And please attach yourself to individuals like us, because you know most of us attach ourselves to negative energy. And it's so funny that if we only listen to our own advice, because we hear that little angel within us telling us what's right and what's not right. But again, some of us do need that support, and there's nothing wrong with finding support. There's nothing wrong with that. You are not alone. But you have to understand that you bring life to this earth. You can want to bring the person that's going to heal this cancer and the AIDS, what have you. Women, you have this potential. You are great, and you are a blessing. But, yeah, that's my little piece right there again, brother. And, yes, again, I reiterate, you was very correct on that. Because I know it's almost 9 o'clock, and I don't know how far you want to go.
Well, one of the things that I like to express to women is that, you know, I oftentimes hear males in the role of the police instead of the police trying to arrest a woman's personal growth and development, saying to them things like, you can't turn a hoe into a housewife. And no, you can't turn a hoe into a housewife, but a hoe can turn themselves into a housewife. And when I say the term hoe, I don't mean that that is only indicative of women, because there are men who are definitely suffering from low self-esteem as well, because I know I definitely did. So I definitely was in my hoe season till I graduated to my growth season. And I just say to so many women, you know, we all have different things that place us at that point in life in which we fall victim and get caught up in that situation, that unconstructive cycle in which we embrace our whole self-esteem, and, you know, we do things that are not to our greater benefit. But the bottom line is, you have to be authentic to who you are, and at some point in your life, when
hello, are you there?